just got gravity and a scalar field with a potential. And we're looking at the perturbations, and we saw that basically the dynamical degrees of freedom, there's one dynamical degree of freedom, which is a scalar, that's zeta, this co-moving curvature perturbation, and then there's also the tensor mode, which have two polarizations. So in the first lecture, we looked at the metric in co-moving gauge. So this is just a recap. Yeah, so in co-moving gauge, the metric perturbation, it just took this simple form here. So we just had minus 2 zeta, delta ij, and then we had the gravitons. Don't need that, do we? Yeah, so this was zeta here, the co-moving curvature perturbation, because the curvature of spatial slices turns out to be proportional to zeta, and also the inflaton perturbation in this gauge vanished. And we worked out the action. Let's try and raise that. Yeah, so what we did is we worked out the quadratic action for zeta and for the gravitons, and we worked out the classical equation of motion for zeta. So what we did is we introduced a different variable, nu, this Mukhanov variable that was related to zeta like this. This z here was a phi primed over h, and nu obeyed this mode equation. So we just solved the classical equations of motion. We got this mode equation here. This was just this simple harmonic oscillator with a time-dependent mass here. And we saw in last lecture how to solve this equation using the slow roll approximation, where this equation just becomes a Bessel equation. So this factor here goes as like 2 over conformal time squared. So at very early times, this term dominates over that one, and we just get modes oscillating. So at very early times, the modes feel like they're in Minkowski space. They just oscillate. And at late times, this term dominates, and we get nu undergoes power law growth, but zeta goes to a constant. So the two things we did yesterday. So one is we solved this equation here, and then at early times, the initial conditions for this equation were the Bunch-Davis vacuum. Which just said that at early times, nu q has to go as 1 over root 2 q e to the minus iq tau. So this is in the far past. And then at late times, we got the power spectrum. Yeah, so at late times, we worked out the power spectrum for zeta. So remember, the definition of the power spectrum was related to the variance in position space. So the definition of the power spectrum here was that it's the contribution to the variance in position space per log interval of wave numbers. And we worked it out using this formula here. So it's just the mod squared of the mode function zeta at late times. And we can convert zeta into the Mukhanov variable mu, nu. Like this. So I guess I just wanted to recap, first of all, so we solved the mode equation quite carefully using Bessel functions, or you're using Hankel functions. And I just want to talk a little bit more about the quantization, you know, how we get this Bunch-Davis vacuum condition here. So you've seen this before in Latham's lectures last year, but I just thought, since it seemed a bit unfamiliar, we'd just quickly go over that once more. So the quantization of perturbations. So the idea is you just start off with a field and the canonical momenta, and you promote these to operators. So this variable nu, which is basically just zeta in disguise, gets promoted to an operator. plus the complex conjugate. Yeah, so it's useful to have an expression in. I'll just write this out. Oops. So it's useful to have an expression for the quantized operator in momentum space here. So to get, so in a sense, you've seen this expression before, but what you can do is if you look at this part here, if we send q goes to minus q, that will flip that minus iq to a plus iq, and hence we can put it in here. So basically, this operator here in momentum space Yeah, so just useful to see this trick before, you know. So you start off with a field, the quantized expression for the field in position space here. And then what you can do is you can send q to minus iq to write it as a pure Fourier transform like this. So then in momentum space, the quantized operator looks like this. And because we sent q to minus q, this sign here, you get a minus sign here. And in the mode function here, you know, this is a solution of the mode equation up there. This only depends on the magnitude of the momentum. It doesn't depend on its position. You know, this is the square root of vector q squared. So if we send q to minus q, this doesn't change sign. So I just wanted to show you where that expression came from, because you often see this written, and it's good just to go from here to there. So when you quantize the field, so that was the field. This is Mukhanov variable nu, which is basically zeta in disguise. There was also, the other thing you have to do is you take the canonical momentum. So the canonical momentum is just d Lagrangian d nu prime, which is nu prime. This was why we had to work out the action in the first place. You might think, you know, since all we've used so far apparently is this mode equation here, you might have thought we could have just solved the linearized Einstein, we could have just worked out the equations of motion, which requires doing linear order perturbation theory. But instead, we went to quite a bit of trouble to compute the action. And the reason why we did that is so that we could compute the canonical momentum. And we're going to need this canonical momentum in order to fix the normalization of the mode function. We'll see this in just a second. So when you quantize, the canonical momentum nu again goes to an operator. And this operator is just the time derivative of this operator here. So the canonical momentum is just with a prime here and a prime there. Okay, so when you quantize, you get these canonical commutation relations. I'm just going to call that CCR. It's down. Yeah, so again, you've seen these before, so this is largely just for completeness. Okay, so of course, creation and annihilation operators, they're commutative at different frequencies, and the only time you get a non-zero right-hand side is if these two frequencies are the same. And of course, creation operators, two creation operators commute as do two annihilation operators. You've also got the canonical commutation relations for the field and its canonical momentum. So at equal times, nu and its canonical momentum So normally I'm going to set h bar to 1, so this would vanish. Bear in mind, this plus sign here is interesting. You know, there's a minus sign here, but there's a plus sign here. The reason why is that, so this is the canonical commutation relation equal times in momentum space. So the one you normally see is you start off in position space, where you have a delta function x minus x prime. So the two fields commute at different points. But when you Fourier transform to momentum space, that becomes a plus cube, that becomes a plus sign here. So just, you know, watch out, there's a different sign here and here. Oh, well, yeah. Okay, so in order for those two to be consistent, this gives you something called the Wronskian relation. You see, if you take this expression here for the field and also for its canonical momentum, if you plug these into here and use these creation and annihilation operators, there's a consistency relation that comes out. You find that this mode function here has to obey this relation. So taken together, these imply I'll put in the H bar just for show. Yeah, so if you put these two together, you get this condition here. So this is called the Wronskian relation, because this thing here is a Wronskian. Yeah, you probably remember the first time you did like ordinary differential equation courses. Remember there's like, you know, there's two solutions of a second order differential equation, and if you want to check the two solutions are linearly independent, you look at this Wronskian function, and you know, if they're linearly dependent, the Wronskian vanishes, and if the Wronskian is non-zero, then you can construct a second solution using the Wronskian. So this left-hand side is just a Wronskian because, you know, nu star is this, you can think of nu and nu star as the two independent solutions of the equations of motion. And so basically quantum mechanics fixes the normalization of nu through this relationship here. Right. Yeah, so I just wanted to recap briefly on the Bunch-Davis vacuum. We sort of used that very quickly last time without really explaining where it came from. So I just want to remind you again where that came from. So at early, let's see, yeah. Yeah, vacuum. Yeah, so at early times, basically, the curvature, you know, during inflation, the co-moving horizon is shrinking with time. So if you follow time backwards instead, the horizon is growing. And any perturbation mode, you know, of whatever wavelength, if you go sufficiently far back in time, it feels like it's well inside the horizon. In other words, you know, the wavelength of the mode, the co-moving wavelength of the mode is very small compared to the size of the co-moving horizon. So in that regime, you know, the effect of space-time chalk dust. The effect of space-time curvature is negligible. The mode feels like it's in Minkowski space. So for any q at sufficiently early times, we're well inside the horizon. And in that case, the Mukhanov, so remember this Mukhanov equation for the modes. So at very early times, when we're well inside the horizon, we can basically just drop that term. This term becomes very small compared to this term. And the two solutions we have are just these oscillating modes. Well, the book I write tends to. Yeah, so it just becomes a simple harmonic oscillator. We have two solutions going, it's e to the plus iq and e to the minus iq. We saw this last time. Remember we had these Hankel function solutions, and at very early times the Hankel functions just went as e to the plus ix and e to the plus ix and e to the minus ix, and x was minus q tau. So that's just these two solutions here. And the idea of the bunched... Oh, yeah, so we, first of all, if we just use that Wronskian relation there, so first of all, the Wronskian relation just gives you a condition, well, it gives you one condition on these arbitrary constants. Now put it up there. I'll put it in the H-bar just for now, because I'd like to show you where the H-bar ends up in the power spectrum at the end of the day. And there should be a over to Q as well, yep. Yeah, okay, so the Wronskian relation gives us one condition. So basically, it's a second-order differential equation. There are two solutions parameterized by these two arbitrary constants here, or really they're functions of the momentum Q, because every mode can have different arbitrary constants. So one condition on these two solutions here comes from the Wronskian relation. The other condition is some physical input, and this is the idea of the Bunch-Davis vacuum. So we think about a co-moving observer. So for a co-moving observer, you know, it's one who just sits at constant co-moving x-coordinate, his time evolution operator is I d by d tau. That's his time evolution operator. So when we look at these two solutions, in fact, only this one has positive energy, has positive frequency as seen by this co-moving observer. This guy here, if you operate, this guy here has negative energy as seen by the co-moving observer. You know, if you plug this guy in, you know, if you operate on the solution goes e to the minus iq tau, then you will get plus q e to the minus iq tau. So basically, this guy has positive frequency seen by the co-moving observer, and this solution here has negative frequency seen by the co-moving observer. So the idea of the Bunch-Davis vacuum condition is just that we select the solution that has positive frequency seen by the co-moving observer. So, you know, this is the one we want. This is the one we want, and this is the one we throw away. So basically, this amounts to saying, so we set the negative, so that's this line here, negative energy, positive energy. So that sets the negative energy solution to zero, and we just keep the positive frequency solution. And then by this condition here, we get the amplitude. Oh, sorry, the I drops out when you put it in, because when you differentiate here, you bring down a factor of I, and that cancels with the I on the right-hand side there, so there's no I here. Yep, so this is just the Bunch-Davis vacuum. This is what we saw last time. This is what we have at the top there, the initial conditions. I've just set h bar to 1 up there. So that was just a sort of reminder of where all this came from. Good. And, oh yes, the final part was we used the power spectrum. So what you had to do is you had to do this condition. I showed you this last time, but we had this formula for the power spectrum that was like q cubed over 2 pi squared. And we showed how to derive this at the end of last time. Remember, basically, you know, the operator zeta is just 1 over z times this operator here. So if you just, you know, if you just use this expression here, and then you try and compute, if you try and compute the variance in position space, so to get this expression here, you just use the quantized expression for the field, and you evaluate this variance in position space here, and then you can work out what this guy is here in terms of the mode functions. So we ran through that very briefly at the end of last lecture. Okay, so in a sense, that was just a recap of the story last time. So last time, we solved the mode equation in terms of Hankel functions, and we used the initial conditions of Bunch-Davis vacuum, and we used this formula to work out the power spectrum at late times. At late time, zeta goes to a constant, so this power spectrum becomes constant. And the result we found were these slow roll power spectra. So SR is slow roll. I'll put in factors of h bar and the Planck mass just in these formula here. Yeah, so these are the sort of main headline results. Okay, so let's just make a few comments about this. So remember the Planck mass here, for this lecture it's useful to restore the Planck mass because we're going to see things like, you know, what distance does the field travel? So it's useful to restore the Planck mass because we can say how far does the field travel compared to the Planck scale? So it's useful to restore the Planck scale in what's going to follow. Yeah, so remember the Planck scale was just 8 pi g. It was this 1 over 8 pi g, which is, this was just a reduced Planck mass. So the h-bar, let's see where that h-bar comes from. So when we derived this result last time, we were just working in units where h-bar and then Planck were 1. So I put them back in now. Where does this h-bar come from? So you can see that, so the normalization of the mode, so the power spectrum here is basically the mod squared of the mode. The Wronsky relation here involves an h-bar because it comes from the commutator. So when we worked out the Bunch-Davis vacuum, we found that there was a root h-bar. So each mode went as root h-bar, and because the power spectrum is the mod squared of the mode function, that gives you back an h-bar here. Remember, these stars were indicating evaluated at horizon crossing. So horizon crossing was defined as the time when the co-moving Hubble rate is equal to the momentum of the perturbation. And remember, when you put a star on quantities, it just means evaluated at this time when the mode crosses the horizon, tau star. Okay, so that was a scalar power spectrum which we derived in the lecture. And in Dan's tutorial, you went through the calculation for the tensor power spectrum. So again, just to recap briefly, the definition of the tensor power spectrum . So remember, the scalar power spectrum was related to the variance in position space. So there's a similar formula here. The tensors have indices ij, so you have to contract over these indices by summing. So you sum over I from 1 to 3, and you sum over j from 1 to 3. Yeah, so this was the definition of the tensor power spectrum. It basically mirrors the definition for the scalar power spectrum. It's just that we have to contract the indices like this because they've got, this is a tensor rather than a scalar. And when you work it out, there's a similar formula. So you probably saw it, but similar to this formula here, remember the scalar power spectrum is related to the mod squared of the mode function. For the tensors, there's a similar relation where the tensor power spectrum is also related to the mod squared of the mode function. So when you quantize a graviton, you have these mode functions here, the De Bayer equation, very much like that Mukhanov equation, just with Z replaced with A. Anyway, if you want to see more about the details of the derivation of the power spectrum, perhaps we'll discuss it offline. So the main part of today's lecture is I want to tell you how to compute the momentum dependence of these power spectra. Remember, epsilon star and h star, these factors actually depend on the momentum q, because if you look at a different q, you have a different time of horizon crossing, and then the Hubble parameter and the Slowell parameters, these are really functions of time. So basically, these formulae actually encode momentum dependence. So I want to work out what that momentum dependence is, and this is going to be the tilt that we talked about in the first lecture. So let's see. I'll go to this side of the board. Oh, I should say also, the factors of M Planck, remember power spectra here, these are defined to be dimensionless quantities. So to restore factors of M Planck, you can just use dimensions. H has dimension 1, so there's got to be a factor of 1 of M Planck squared in the bottom in order for this guy to be dimensionless. Okay, so let's talk about the tilts, the spectral indices. So there's momentum dependence hidden in those slow roll parameters. Okay. So remember in last lecture,
We actually worked out what this quantity was using slow roll approximation. So remember, in last lecture, we actually worked out this expression here for what the co-moving Hubble parameter is during slow roll inflation. And it just went as, so the Hubble parameter just goes as 1 over tau, that will be what you get for a de Sitter space, minus 1 over tau, that will be get for a de Sitter space. And then because it's slowly rolling, it's not quite de Sitter, so in fact you get this correction factor here of 1 plus the slow roll parameter epsilon. So first of all, you can see from this relation, we can work out how the time of horizon crossing depends on momentum q. So I'm going to make it log q. And, you know, at horizon crossing, q and h star are the same thing. So this is the same thing as 1 over h star, 1 plus epsilon star. Okay. Now, the other thing, remember from last time, I'm going to try and raise. Also, remember from last time, we had this, from the background equations of motion, we had this equation for how epsilon, slow roll epsilon, varies with time. So slow roll epsilon, So from the background equations of motion, we had this equation here, which tells you how the slow roll parameter varies with time. So if we put these two together, we can get an equation for how epsilon varies with momentum. So in other words, to work out how this depends with momentum, we need to know how h star depends on momentum, and we need to know how epsilon star depends on momentum. So first of all, epsilon, d epsilon d log q. So just using the chain rule, first of all, you can write this as d epsilon star d tau star, and then you can use d tau star d log q. So d epsilon d tau star, we have from this equation here, this prime is d by d tau, and we have d tau dq from this equation here. So if you put those two together, you just get 2 epsilon star and eta star. Okay, so that's how epsilon depends, that's how epsilon evaluated at the time of horizon crossing depends on momentum. The other thing in this formula here, the other factor that appears in this formula here is h star, so we need to work out how h star depends on momentum. Now remember, this is the proper Hubble radius, it's not a curly h star, it's a proper Hubble time, proper Hubble rate. So, yeah, so remember, horizon crossing is when q is equal to co-moving Hubble rate, but the co-moving Hubble rate is related to the proper Hubble rate just by this formula here. Yeah, remember, this is a primed over a, where prime is with derivative with respect to conformal time. H is a dot over a, where the dot is with respect to proper time. So you put them together, you get this relation here. So if I want to work out what d log h star dq is, d log q is. So first of all, this guy is just q over a star. Okay, which is then 1 minus okay, so h is just q over a star, that's here. The first term, d log q by d log q, gives the 1. The second term here gives you d a star d log q, and just using the chain rule, I've written that as d log a star d tau dq. This factor here, you know, that's just a primed over a, so that's just the co-moving Hubble parameter. And d tau star d log q we worked out up there. So if you put those two together, we just get minus epsilon star. Okay, and then we're done, right? So the power spectrum depend on the proper Hubble parameter H, and they depend on epsilon star. And we've worked out how both of these depend on momentum. So we can put it together now to work out the tilts. So remember, the scalar tilt, that was this parameter, ns minus 1. So we can really, if you like, we can define it. I'll write this as an equal sign, but really this is a definition. So it's the derivative of the log of the power spectrum with respect to log momenta. Remember in the first lecture, we said from the data, to a good approximation, it appears that the scalar power spectra takes a sort of simple power law form. You know, it had an amplitude you. So in terms of actually just fitting the raw data, we find it looks like to a good approximation that the scalar power spectrum just takes this power law form here. You had some reference scale, some pivot scale, Q naught, and then it just goes as Q to some power ns minus 1. So basically, another way of thinking about this definition is that ns minus 1 is really d log of this guy with respect to d log Q. That's this definition here. So in a sense, you know, this is a more general definition. It doesn't rely on the fact that, you know, this is just a sort of empirical, you know, this is just an empirical observation from the CMB data, whereas this definition is much more general. This applies for whatever the shape of the power spectrum is. So really, this is the proper definition of what the spectral index is. So this is the scalar tilt here. Okay, so if you plug that in there, so, you know, we just get d log h, and then we want a piece, you know, d log epsilon dq. So just plugging in our results, we get minus 4 epsilon star minus 2 eta star. Remember also there were these different slow roll parameters. So just, you know, you often see this different set of slow roll parameters defined with respect to the potential. And remember, the relation between the two was that the epsilon v was equal to out eta here minus epsilon, and the two epsilons were equal to first order and slow roll. So we did this at the start of last lecture, just reminding you that there are two different commonly used definitions of the slow roll parameters. So we could also rewrite this in terms of the other set of slow roll parameters defined with respect to the potential. I'll remind you of the definition again in a few lines, but if you just plug in the relation here to convert to the other slow roll parameters, yes, you get minus there, plus 2 here. Similarly for the tensors, so this is going to be the tensor tilt, or the tensor spectral index. So this is defined analogously to the scalar power spectrum. Yes, the important point is there's no minus 1 factor here. So essentially for random historical accident reasons, the scalar power spectrum was defined with a minus 1 here, but the tensor tilt wasn't. Sorry, Matt, you had a...
Yeah, just
giving
eta v is eta minus.
Sorry, eta v is... I think... Oh, yes, sorry, thanks. Yes, that makes a lot more sense. So, good. Yeah, okay, so the tensor power spectrum is defined essentially without that factor of minus 1 there for historical reasons. So it's literally just the derivative with respect to log momentum of the log of the power spectrum. Plugging in our results here, you just get minus 2 epsilon star, and the two epsilons are the same. Yeah, the two different slow roll parameter epsilons are the same. Okay? So these are key results here. Actually, I have one more thing I want to put on that board. So one thing's fun is if you put these two together, you can also get a relation for the tensor to scalar power remember there was this quantity R, which was like the tensor to scalar ratio. I think I'll write that out. I just want to fit it on this board here. So So this tensor to scalar ratio, it's a ratio of tensor power over scalar power. So it's like the tensor power spectrum divided by the scalar power spectrum. And we can work it out because you see from those formulae up here, the tensor power spectrum divided by the scalar power spectrum is proportional to epsilon. You know, the epsilon only appears in the scalar power spectrum. So from that formula there, at the very top, it's 16 epsilon star. But this is kind of fun because the tensor tilt here is just 2 epsilon star. So in fact, you can rewrite this, or minus 2, so you can rewrite this as minus 8 the tensor tilt. So this is kind of, this is a really cool relation, right? Okay, so this tells you that the, you know, if you know, for example, if you have a measurement of what the tensor power spectrum is, you know, we know the scalar power spectrum for quite some time, we know the amplitude of the scalar power spectrum. If, say, some experiment such as BICEP came along and told us what the tensor power spectrum was, then we could work out, you know, so BICEP tells us what this tensor to scalar ratio is, so that gives us a prediction for the tilt of the tensor power spectrum. So this is an amazing relation. And, you know, if we're lucky, we might actually even be able to test this experimentally within a couple of years, fingers crossed. So this guy here is called the consistency relation. So really, you know, a single field slow roll consistency relation. Single field slow roll consistency relation. See, you know, this is essentially model independent. As long as you've got slow roll and a single field, you know, we derive those formulae there for the power spectrum quite generally. So this result here is quite a general prediction. It links the tensor to scalar ratio to the tensor tilt. So for example, you know, if the recent data suggests that R is 0.2 from BICEP, then this would predict a tensor tilt of minus 0.025. So okay, you know, this is gonna be very, very challenging to measure, but it's not impossible that you might be able to test this relation experimentally. You know, if this fails, then we're in big trouble. So this is really a prediction here. Okay, so I just had a few sort of comments to sort of wrap things up. So basically, H star and epsilon star depend on momentum Q, and that's how we're getting this tilt of the spectrum. The spectrum is really depending on momentum. But in fact, the tilt is also a function of momentum too. You know, epsilon eta star, these guys depend on momentum Q itself. So in fact, there's higher derivatives in the spectrum. You know, the first log derivative of the power spectrum is the tilt. But you can also define higher derivatives, such as the second derivative, which would be the running. This is just a sort of comment for completeness, but you often hear cosmologists talking about the running of the spectrum. You know, for example, you might call it something like, say, alpha s, and that will be just a second log derivative. So d squared and, you know, that will basically go as like d epsilon d log q and d eta d log q. And then that's second order in slow roll. Because remember, so basically, you know, epsilon prime goes as epsilon squared plus epsilon eta. So basically, derivatives of the slow roll parameter are second order in slow roll. They're proportional to slow roll parameters squared. So in slow roll inflation, the running is sort of second order in slow roll, meaning it goes as slow roll parameters squared. So another prediction of inflation is that the running of the spectrum, that's the second log derivative of the power spectrum, is going to be very small. It's going to be suppressed by an extra factor of slow roll parameters relative to the tilt, which is first order in slow roll. So that was just a comment. Another comment, so let's use the CMB data. Let's just plug in a few numbers. Okay, so we know from the CMB that NS is about 0.96. We know from BICEP, we think that the running is about, the tensor to scalar ratio is about 0.2. So we can now solve for the slow roll parameters. So just plugging the numbers approximately, we find epsilon, which is the same thing as this epsilon V star. It's probably a bit too much to give all the... Basically, this one's about 10 to the minus 2. Let's try and raise this. Yeah, so the first slow roll parameter is about 10 to the minus 2, and then the second slow roll parameter. So first of all, this one, eta star, these should really be approximately equal. You know, there's a lot of, I'm just trying to give you a rough order of magnitude of everything. This is about of order 5 times 10 to the minus 3. And the other slow roll parameter, defined with respect to the potential, this one is about 10 to the minus 2 times 10 to the minus 3. So it's about 0.017. So don't take the actual numbers too seriously. The main point is that epsilon is about 10 to the minus 2, whereas eta, this eta here, is about 2 times 10 to the minus 2. But the main point is that once you know, for example, the tensor to scalar ratio and the spectral tilt, you can compute all the slow roll parameters. You have enough information to sort of compute the whole system. Okay, remember, let's go back to the definitions of these guys. So let me remind you again of the definition. So remember, the slow roll parameters here defined with respect to the potential. This guy was this one here, and the other slow roll parameter, eta v, So, you know, if these slow roll parameters here are of order 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus, yeah, we have 10 to the minus 2, that tells you that the potential is very flat. Right, like that. So in other words, it tells you that V prime has got to be very small compared to V, and it tells you that V double prime has also got to be very small compared to V. Slightly counterintuitive, this definition of flatness. I mean, if you think of something like a parabola, you know, V is proportional to phi squared, that actually qualifies as flat because you wouldn't normally think of a parabola as being flat, but actually the point is, you know, if you had, in fact, any monomial, you know, if V went as phi to some power n, then basically if you work out, you know, epsilon goes as V prime over V, so it goes as 1 over phi squared, and eta again goes as double prime over V. So this also goes as 1 over phi squared. I don't care about these numerical factors here. So in fact, for any monomial potential, provided you go sufficiently far up the hill, provided phi is sufficiently large, then basically slow roll is satisfied and the potential is flat if you go sufficiently far up the hill. So remember, flatness is saying the derivatives are small compared to the scale set by the potential itself. So something like a monomial potential actually is flat if you go sufficiently far up the hill. So, okay, so, you know, there's a bit of a, so this is sort of begging the question, you know, how do you get a potential that satisfies these flatness conditions? So, you know, basically, inflation will predict the right form for the power spectrum, but there's a certain element of fine tuning involved. You know, we have to ensure that these potentials are sufficiently flat. So I just want to inject a note of caution that, I mean, you know, it's not also, there's possibly an element of fine tuning involved to get the sufficiently flat potential so that you get small epsilon eta, so that you get a nearly scale invariant power spectra. So remember, remember, if ns were exactly 1, that would be what we call a scale invariant power spectrum. The power spectrum would be independent of momenta. So the fact that these slow roll parameters are small, that tells us that the power spectrum is nearly scale invariant. But to get these nearly scale invariant power spectra, you know, we need these slow roll parameters to be small, which requires the potential to be very, very flat. So there's an element of fine tuning required in order to get the near scale invariants of the spectrum. The other element of fine tuning kicks in when you try and work out the energy scale of inflation. So let's see, I'd like a fresh blackboard, so I'm going to start here. Okay. Yes, this bit's kind of fun. This is where we get to see the energy scale of inflation. So okay, so first of all, you know, if we look at the formula for the tensor power spectrum there, from the tensor power spectrum you can work out, so H star squared over M Planck squared is pi squared over 2 times the tensor power spectrum, just from the formula up on the top. Now, the tensor to scalar ratio is, so you can rewrite this as R times the scalar power spectrum. Okay, so this was just rearranging the formula, the Slowell formula for the tensor power spectrum. And remember, R is the tensor power spectrum divided by the scalar power spectrum. They will just, just this guy here. So if we know the tensor to scalar ratio R, and if we know the amplitude of the scalar power spectrum, which we do, we can compute what the Hubble parameter H star was, you know, the Hubble parameter at horizon crossing. So, you know, we think R is 0.2 from BICEP, and the amplitude of the scalar power spectrum we know is about 2 times 10 to the power, 10 to the minus 9. So if you put those together, you can compute what H is, what H star is. So in other words, what is the Hubble parameter? This is the proper Hubble parameter. What's its value when the modes we see in the CMB cross the horizon? So plugging in the numbers, you get so H at horizon crossing is about 10 to the minus 5 times the Planck scale, M Planck. If you put in the actual value for M Planck, then you get about 10 to the 14 GeV. And it's also useful to write this in terms of the potential. So remember the Friedman equation. Remember the first Friedman equation said something like H squared is 1/3 rho. And remember, you know, for a single scalar field, the energy density is like half phi dot squared plus the potential. But doing slow roll, you know, the field is rolling very slowly down the potential. So in effect, that term, the kinetic energy term, is negligible compared to the potential. So basically, during slow roll, H squared is just proportional to 1/3 V. So we can rewrite this H star here in terms of V. You know, what is the value of the potential at horizon crossing? So if you put that together, so the value of the potential at horizon crossing, we can just write, you know, we can write this as the scalar power spectrum times the tensor to scalar ratio, and then there's M Planck to the fourth, because the potential has dimensions mass to the power fourth. So in a sense, you know, it's useful to write, when we talk about energy scale, we really want something with units of energy, M Planck. So it's useful, what we normally do is we take the quarter, we put this equation to the power 1/4 to get an energy scale. So by energy scale of inflation, people usually mean V to the power 1/4. This has dimensions of just mass of energy. So if you just put this equation to the power 1/4, and you get this relation here. So I'll just write it out. It's the power 1/4, and then there's a factor of 10 to 16. Yeah, okay. So we worked out the Hubble parameter at horizon crossing, and from that we can work out the potential. Maybe there should be a star here, the value of the potential at the horizon crossing. Potential has units of energy to the power fourth. So we take the fourth root, and this is what we mean by the energy scale inflation here. Energy scale of inflation, this is often called. So what I've done is I've just put in values for R and for the amplitude of the tensor power spectrum, and I've rearranged it to write it in this form here. So this is kind of a useful way of writing things because, you know, typically people... So we know the amplitude of the scalar power spectrum very well. The tensor to scalar ratio, R, is less well known, so we write it in this form here. So that if you give me a value for R, such as if Bicep comes along and says R is 0.2, then you can plug it into this formula here and work out the energy scale straight off. So this is just a rearranging... I've literally just rearranged this formula here and plugged in the value for the amplitude here. But it's nice because... yeah, so if you put in R as 0.2, then the energy scale comes out. This is an amazing result. The energy scale comes out as 2 to the 16 JeV, which for comparison, this is just 1/100th of the Planck mass. So I mean, this is kind of an amazing result, right? The energy scale of inflation, you know, the... So this is like the energy density in the field when modes cross the horizon, and then you take the quarter, you put to the power, take the fourth root to get the energy scale of inflation, plug in the numbers, the energy scale of inflation is just 1/100th of the Planck scale. So this is incredibly high energy physics. You know, for comparison, you know, these paltry experiments like the LHC, I mean, the LHC, you know, the current beam energy is what, the center of mass energy is like 7 TeV, maybe it'll go up to 14, we hope, with no explosions. But I mean, if you know, that's 7,000 JeV. So if you take the ratio, you know, inflation, the energy scale of inflation is a factor of 3 times 10 to the 12 higher than the LHC center of mass. So this is incredibly high energy physics we're talking about here. So in a sense, it's incredible that, you know, by looking out there and taking measurements of the CMB, we can get ideas about the physics operating at scales of just 1/100th of the Planck scale in energy. You know, this is incredible. Also, just a time scale of this process. If you think, you know, if you want 60 e-folds of inflation, how long do we need to get 60 e-folds? You know, all the scales we see today, we need about 60 e-folds of inflation in order so that all the scales we see in the universe today were inside the horizon at sufficiently early times. You know, how long does this take? How long does it take to go through 60 e-folds? So it takes a time 60 over h star. You know, during inflation, the scale factor goes roughly as e to the ht. So, you know, to do one e-fold, which is to increase by a factor of e, you need a time 1 over h. So to get 60 e-folds, you need a time approximately 6 over h star. We just worked out what h star is. If you plug in the numbers, this comes out as 4 times 10 to the power minus 37 seconds. So we spent nearly 3 hours getting to this point, but this entire process happens in about 4 times 10 to the minus 37 seconds. So yeah, just shows you how slow we are, right? Matt had a nice comment about this too. I mean, in a sense, you know, this is how we're actually getting a power spectrum big enough to see. You know, space-time is expanding so incredibly fast that it's really shaking up the vacuum enough in order to produce a power spectrum big enough for us to observe. So, you know, in a sense, the fact that this is such a rapid expansion is what's necessary in order to produce a spectrum that's big enough for us to see. You know, there's a factor of h bar in those formula there, and h bar is a very small number. So we basically need a very rapid expansion in order to make the amplitude of the power spectrum big enough for us to see. It's still very small. You know, the amplitude of the power spectrum is, 2 times 10 to the minus 9. This fluctuation zeta we're talking about is about, you know, so this is like zeta squared. So zeta is about 10 to the minus 5. And zeta basically relates to delta t over t, the fractional fluctuation in the temperature of the power spectrum, which is about 10 to the minus 5 as well. So, you know, we need this super rapid expansion in order to generate a big enough amplitude that we can see. We can detect it in the CMB. Yeah, so I think that's kind of, I think these numbers are really cool. Let's just, okay, I'm just going to go for this board here. Bust. Yeah. So the other thing I just want to talk about briefly in the last couple of minutes was how far does the field travel during inflation? So we've seen it happens at these incredibly high energy scales. Let's also ask, how far does the field travel? You know, what is the field range for the inflaton? So you saw this a bit in the tutorials, so I just want to sort of quickly run over it here. This is often called the life bound. The bound is a bit historical by now, but you often hear people call it the life bound. But basically, they just mean how far did the inflaton field travel during inflation. So in fact, there's a sort of simple way of working it out. So I'm going to call n the number of e fold. So n log a number of e fold is the number of e folds. Okay, so how does the inflaton vary as the number of e folds increases? So, you know, this is d phi d log a. So whenever you have expressions like this, actually it's quite nice just to take the time derivative of the top and bottom. So this thing is actually equal to phi dot over log a dot. You just take the time derivative of the top and bottom. This is a sort of manipulation you actually do all the time in these calculations. It's quite a useful thing just to note that explicitly. So log a dot, that's just h. Okay. And if you go back to your notes, we had this definition of the slow roll parameter epsilon. Remember, the slow roll parameter epsilon was like phi dot squared over 2h squared. And let's see, so that's energy to the fourth, that's energy squared, so we need a m Planck squared in the bottom there so that this slow roll parameter is dimensionless. Sorry, that's a 2. But so you can see that this is basically just the square root of 2h times m Planck. Okay, so that was just plugging in the definition of the slow roll parameter, which we had from last lecture. And we saw on the board over there, this one here. So epsilon is just related to R, the tensor to scalar ratio. So we can plug this in here. So this is also the tensor scalar ratio over 8, take the square root, times by m Planck. So the nice thing is that basically, during inflation, so this guy goes as epsilon, and remember the time derivative of epsilon is second order in slow roll. So basically, this guy is approximately constant during slow roll era, at least a first order in slow roll. So to first order, this is approximately constant. So if you integrate this, you can take this out of the integral. So if you want to work out how far does the field travel during inflation, that's delta phi. In Planck units. So that's just given by the integral So how far does a field travel during inflation? It's just given by the integral of this guy here, but this guy is approximately constant during inflation. So first order and slow roll, we can just write this as R over 8 times the number of e-folds. So this is number of e-folds of inflation, and this is how far the field travels, the field range, if you like. So it's kind of fun. You can sort of plug in numbers. So for example, if R was 0.2, then you find that delta phi over m Planck is something like 8 to 10. I'm just being approximate here. You could also do, if you take a particular value of a potential, like say m squared phi squared, you can do a bit more of an accurate approximation. So if you took, for example, an m squared phi squared potential, then you can do this integral and you find that you get about 15, delta phi is about 15 m Planck. So yeah, this is the last point I want to make, but in a sense this is crucially important. So for these single field slow roll models, basically we find that the fields travel a super Planckian distance. So yeah, so this is really quite a striking conclusion. Not only is the energy scale of inflation around a hundredth of the Planck mass, the distance traveled by the inflaton starts up 10, 15 times the Planck scale. You know, that's the initial value of the field. It travels much more than the Planck scale as it rolls down the hill. So the key question is, does this make sense? How do we make sense of this? So this is, in a sense, a very big issue. This is really a whole lecture in itself, but I'd like to encourage you to read more about it in, for example, Daniel Bauman and Liam McAllister's new book, which is available on the archive. I gave you the reference in the first lecture. There's a nice whole chapter discussing this. But you want to look at how do we think of inflation as an effective field theory. And there's also something called the eater problem. So in view of the time, I'll stop here and we'll carry on next lecture. Thank you.